Tape number 3 on the Acts of the Apostles, the Epistles and Revelation. Gordon Brown.
Well, let's just complete our glimpse then of this glorious fourth vision of the God-crowned woman at the determining centre of the whole panorama. You see, just as the Virgin Mary birthed the personal representative of the Christ idea in the form of Christ Jesus at the point of the first messianic mission, so at the point of the second, this same quality of virgin motherhood in generic man, when, of course, we look away from the mortal evidence of a fallen Adamic race of mankind and see generic man as a spiritual idea of God symbolized by the woman in the Apocalypse, this same quality of virgin motherhood in generic man births the impersonal representative of the Christ idea preeminently in the form of the textbook of the science of the whole world's being. Said Mary Baker Eddy, it's human scribe under orders. I should blush to write of science and health with key to the scriptures, as I have, were it of human origin, or were I, apart from God, its author. And because humanity, at the sounding of the sixth trumpet, is given in this book the truth of its identity as the spiritual idea of God, it's already equipped with the antidote to the great red dragon, which otherwise would devour it and render it impotent. That's to say, would take away its power over unconscious and conscious evil by breaking up its wholeness into disconnected fragments and so depriving it of life. What ensues, therefore, is war in heaven between the woman and the dragon, between the woman who is in heaven and the dragon who claims to be in heaven. Claims to be, such that in the words of Paul, he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. But it's Michael and Gabriel, God's two foremost angels, who actually carry out this warfare and cast the dragon and his angels from heaven to earth. His angel, says the textbook, being lust and hypocrisy, identical therefore with those two beasts who are shortly to rise up out of the sea and out of the earth, if, to all intents and purposes, science and health's twofold power is not being exercised over the sea and over the earth. Because this is precisely what seems to happen when we come to Revelation 13, after the woman has concluded her triumphant mission in Revelation 12, and her followers fail to understand her provisions for the future of her church, and so they disobey her God-given instructions. Because gradually after this, the church organization ceases to grow and begins to deteriorate, just as in the case, apparently, of the early Christian church, which, as we remember, Paul deplores so much in his second pastoral letter to Timothy. But we're still thinking at the moment of how the woman, through the agency of Michael and Gabriel, wages what she calls the divine method of warfare in science against the dragon and his two angels. It's actually Michael, of course, who fights the holy wars, but this is only because he's working from the standpoint of the Gabriel of love's ever-presence, where there aren't any wars to be fought. And so we begin to see what is meant by the warfare taking place divinely in science. Because up to this point in the Apocalypse chapter, in Science and Health, the terms for science that have been used have either been science by itself or divine science. Showing really that what casts the dragon subjectively out of heaven is science as divine science, but that now when it becomes necessary to cast him objectively out of earth as well, the text for the first time in the chapter uses the term Christian science in its aspect as Christian science. Now this, of course, can be verified by any one of us by carefully examining the text. And once he's disposed of on earth as well as in heaven, then of course he's disposed of altogether, isn't he? So what we need to see now is the way in which he's eliminated on earth, or how science, in its two aspects as divine science and Christian science, eliminates him totally in a process of spiritual and scientific translation. Because however much the old so-and-so tries, he's unable to drown the work of the woman in the flood of terrorism, violence, pornographic propaganda, drug addiction, and so on, which he casts out of his mouth in his efforts to lure humanity away from Christian science. But of course, only temporarily does he seem to succeed in doing this. And why? Because the wonderful thing that now happens is that Mother Earth herself helps the woman. The human race itself starts to awaken at last to the fact that it is the woman, that it is the universal Christ body, and not really a race of male-female mortality controlled involuntarily by the instincts of animal magnetism. In other words, the earth opens her mouth and swallows up in scientific translation the flood of lying propaganda which the dragon casts out of his mouth. The evidence of the senses being thus reversed, we see that nothing really is ever at work but the living presence of God himself. And this means most wonderfully that it's generic man as a whole, all humanity, in its spiritual identity as the woman, who is the one whom, in the words of the textbook, God has appointed to voice his word. The one generically, that is, made up of everyone specifically. As Mrs. Eddy says elsewhere, each of Christ's little ones reflects the infinite one. And to understand this fact in science, that everyone is the one, we cannot logically entertain a false estimate of any one, can we? So not only does the woman, represented humanly by the mission of Mary Baker Eddy, wage the divine method of warfare in science against the apparent forces of evil, but she shows at the same time in her words the glorious results of this warfare. Not only does she lay the foundations and open the gates of mankind's millennial holy city, but she makes it possible for the worldwide city itself to raise itself up on the foundations which she has laid. And therefore it is that she inflicts on animal magnetism what Revelation 13 calls a deadly wound. Nevertheless, as soon as the foundational phase of her mission is concluded, historically in 1910, and the dragon goes to make war with the remnant of her seed, then, to all intents and purposes, this deadly wound is apparently, as the text again says, healed, if only temporarily. Because neither the woman nor her textbook are scientifically understood, neither are complied with nor obeyed. The book's right foot or dominant power is not exercised on the sea, nor its left foot or secondary power on the earth. And therefore it is that as we move from Revelation 12 to Revelation 13, there rises up out of the sea a beast called lust, and out of the earth another one called hypocrisy, the cover-up of lust, as the two servants or angels of the great red dragon. Aided and abetted by the two beasts, the world, in general, worships the dragon. Because the sea beast causes all, great and small, rich and poor, to bow down to an image which is made in his name. Matter, of course, as the image held in mortal mind. And receive in their foreheads his mark and his number. And his numbers, I'm sure we all know, is said to be 666. Now, could this possibly be, do you think, because what he attempts to negate is first what the sixth church stands for, then what the opening of the sixth seal stands for, then what the sounding of the sixth trumpet stands for? I don't know. But it's more satisfactory spiritually to think of it like that, isn't it? And trying to relate it, for example, with the Pope or with Stalin or with Hitler, or trying to, in that way, to personalize it. Any way we can think about that. Yet all this hatred and opposition on the part of the dragon and the two beasts is of no avail. The divine purpose, seen at the opening of the sixth seal, when the seal of the living God seals in their foreheads, the 144,000, as the counter to the mark of the beast. This cannot be thwarted. With the result that we are shown once again, and this is now chapter 14, that same vision of the 144,000 standing with the Lamb on Mount Zion, having not the name of the beast stamped in their foreheads, but impressed indelibly instead with their Father's name. The name in science, of course, of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, love. And this means that a new song can now be sung. And the singers of this song, says the text, are they which are not defiled with women, for they are virgins, and follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. And then comes this lovely thought that these are the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And therefore the song they're singing is really a harvest song, because the time of harvest now has come. And the vision we see, therefore, is that of the Son of Man, the demonstrable understanding of all those who were redeemed from the image of the beast and from Babylon, sitting on a cloud, wearing on his head a golden crown, and having in his hand a sharp sickle. Thrust in thy sickle and reap, cries the angel. And he thrusts his sickle into the earth, and the earth is reaped, so that the clusters of the vines of the earth are gathered, for her grapes are fully ripe. And in an article called Harvest, written in 1906, Mrs. Eddy wrote, God hath thrust in his sickle, and he is separating the tares from the wheat. This hour is molten in the furnace of soul. The harvest song is worldwide, world known, world great. The vine is bringing forth its fruits. And that's Miscellany 269. While in Unity of Good, page 12, she'd written previously, the laborers are few in this vineyard of mind sowing and reaping. But let them apply to the waiting grain the curving sickle of mind's eternal circle, and bind it with bands of soul. Notice the term soul there in both those references, signifying the limitless ingathering of the fruits of harvest. Now that year, 1906, when the first of those two statements was made, was the year when the Mother Church Extension was dedicated, signifying the extending of Christian Science beyond all laws of limitation to feed spiritually the rest of the world. The year that the final copyright on science and health was taken out, and the year when the editions of Science and Health cease to be numbered any longer. See, Mrs. Eddy evidently saw her textbook where it is legally today freely available in the public domain. So what a time of harvest that year 1906 represented, didn't it? So it's at this point of the gathering of the harvest that this glorious fourth vision centered in the work of the God-crowned woman ends. Not its carnal opposite, but the curving sickle of the Son of Man, our man's son, our own spiritual selfhood, born of God and reaping the harvest of mind's universal sowing. And never forget how it's all taking place under the umbrella of the opening of the sixth seal. Typical, as we read, of 6,000 years since Adam, and referring, therefore, as the textbook says, to the present age. So the time of harvest is really now, today, isn't it? As the world stands poised on the brink of the seventh millennium, correlative with the seventh day of creation, the day of the all-embracing love of the universal motherhood of God. And surely this spiritual harvest or fruitage is implied, isn't it, by the wedding in each individual consciousness of the twin advents of the Son of God. The manhood and womanhood missions in holy wedlock of Christ Jesus and Christian Science, elucidated, we see now, by the contents as a whole of the New Testament, but stemming necessarily from the divine principle of the 16 prophets as this closes the Old Testament. Are we happy about that?
Please now turn the tape over for the concluding message.